Cluster Mug. 1. When Big Jim Rennie scrunched to a stop in his H3 Alpha Hummer, color black pearl, accessories, you name it, he was a full 3 minutes ahead of the town cops, which was just the way he liked it. Keep ahead of the competish, that was Rennie's motto. Ernie Calvert was still on the phone, but he raised a hand in a half-assed salute. His hair was in disarray, and he looked nearly insane with excitement.
Yo, Big Jim, I got through to him.
Through to who? Rennie asked, not paying much attention. He was looking at the still-burning pyre of the pulp truck, and at the wreckage of what was clearly a plane. This was a mess. One that could mean a black eye for the town, especially with the two newest fire wagons over in the Rock. A training exercise he had approved of. But Andy Sanders' signature was the one on the approval form because Andy was first selectman. That was good. Rennie was a great believer in what he called the protectability quotient, and being second selectman was a prime example of the quotient in action. You got all of the power, at least when the first was a nit like Sanders, but rarely had to take the blame when things went wrong. And this was what Rennie, who had given his heart to Jesus at age 16 and did not use foul language, called a cluster mug. Steps would have to be taken. Control would have to be imposed. And he couldn't count on that elderly ass Howard Perkins to do the job. Perkins might have been a perfectly adequate police chief 20 years ago, but this was a new century. Rennie's frown deepened as he surveyed the scene. Too many spectators. Of course, there were always too many at things such as this. People love blood and destruction, and some of these appeared to be playing a bizarre sort of game, seeing how far they could lean over or something. Bizarre.
You people get back from there, he shouted.
He had a good voice for giving orders, big and confident.
That's an accident site.
Ernie Calvert, another idiot, the town was full of them, Rennie supposed any town was, tugged at his sleeve. He looked more excited than ever.
Got through to the ANG, Big Jim, and the who, the what are you talking about?
The Air National Guard.
Worse and worse. People playing games, and this fool calling the... Ernie, why would you call them, for gosh sakes?
Because, he said, the guy said... But Ernie couldn't remember exactly what Barbie had said, so he moved on. Well, anyway, the colonel at the ANG listened to what I was telling him, then connected me with Homeland Security in their Portland office, put me right through. Rennie slapped his hands to his cheeks, a thing he did often when he was exasperated. It made him look like a cold-eyed Jack Benny. Like Benny, Big Jim did indeed tell jokes from time to time, always clean ones. He joked because he sold cars, and because he knew politicians were supposed to joke, especially when election time came around. So he kept a small rotating stock of what he called funnies, as in, do you boys want to hear funny? He memorized these much as a tourist in a foreign land will pick up the phrases for stuff like, where is the bathroom? Or, is there a hotel with internet in this village? But he didn't joke now.
Homeland Security? What in the cotton-picking devil for?
Cotton-picking was by far Rennie's favorite epithet. Because the young guy said there's something across the road. And there is, Jim. Something you can't see. People can lean on it. See, they're doing it now. Or if you throw a stone against it, it bounces back. Look. Ernie picked up a stone and threw it. Rennie did not trouble looking to see where it went. He reckoned if it had struck one of the rubberneckers, the fellow would have given a yell. The truck crashed into it, into the whatever it is, and the plane did, too, and so the guy told me to
slow down. What guy exactly are we talking about?
He's a young guy, Rory Dinsmore said. He cooks at Sweetbriar Rose. If you ask for a hamburg medium, that's how you get it. My dad says you can hardly ever get medium because nobody knows how to cook it, but this guy does.
His face broke into a smile of extraordinary sweetness.
I know his name.
Shut up, Roar,
his brother warned. Mr. Rennie's face had darkened. In Ollie Dinsmore's experience, this was the way teachers looked just before they slapped you with a week's worth of detention. Rory, however, paid no mind.
It's a girl's name. It's Barbara.
Just when I think I've seen the last of him, that cotton picker pops up again,
Rennie thought.
That darned useless no-count.
He turned to Ernie Calvert. The police were almost here, but Rennie thought he had time to put a stop to this latest bit of Barbara-induced lunacy. Not that Rennie saw him around. Nor expected to, not really. How like Barbara to stir up the stew, make a mess, then flee.
Ernie, he said, you've been misinformed.
Alden Dinsmore stepped forward. Mr. Rennie, I don't see how you can say that when you don't know what the information is. Rennie smiled at him, pulled his lips back anyway.
I know Dale Barbara, Alden. I have that much information.
He turned back to Ernie Calvert.
Now, if you'll just...
Hush,
Calvert said, holding up a hand.
I got someone.
Big Jim Rennie did not like to be hushed, especially by a retired grocery store manager. He plucked the phone from Ernie's hand as though Ernie were an assistant who had been holding it for just that purpose. A voice from the cell phone said,
To whom am I speaking?
Less than half a dozen words, but they were enough to tell Rennie that he was dealing with a bureaucratic son of a buck. The Lord knew he'd dealt with enough of them in his 3 decades as a town official, and the feds were the worst.
This is James Rennie, second selectman of Chester's Mill. Who are you, sir?
Donald Wozniak, Homeland Security. I understand you have some sort of problem out there on Highway 119, an interdiction of some kind.
Interdiction? Interdiction? What kind of Fed speak was that?
You have been misinformed, sir, Rennie said. What we have is an airplane, a civilian plane, a local plane that tried to land on the road and hit a truck. The situation is completely under control. We do not require the aid of Homeland Security.
Mr. Rennie, the farmer said, that is not what happened.
Rennie flapped a hand at him and began walking around the first police cruiser. Hank Morrison was getting out. Big, 6'5 or so, but basically useless. And behind him, the gal with the big old titties. Weddington, her name was. And she was worse than useless, a smart mouth run by a dumb head. But behind her, Peter Randolph was pulling up. Randolph was the assistant chief, and a man after Rennie's own heart, a man who could get her done. If Randolph had been the duty officer on the night Junior got in trouble at that stupid devil pit of a bar, Big Jim doubted if Mr. Dale Barbara would still have been in town to cause trouble today. In fact, Mr. Barbara might have been behind bars, over in the Rock, which would have suited Rennie fine. Meanwhile, the man from Homeland Security, did they have the nerve to call themselves agents, was still jabbering away. Rennie interrupted him.
Thank you for your interest, Mr. Wozniak, but we've got this handled.
He pushed the end button without saying goodbye. Then he tossed the phone back to Ernie Calvert.
Jim, I don't think that was wise.
Rennie ignored him and watched Randolph stop behind the Weddington gal's cruiser, bubblegum bars flashing. He thought about walking down to meet Randolph and rejected the idea before it was fully formed in his mind. Let Randolph come to him. That was how it was supposed to work. And how it would work, by God. 2.
Big Jim, Randolph said, what's happened here?
I believe that's obvious, Big Jim said. Chuck Thompson's airplane got into a little argument with a pulp truck. Looks like they fought it to a draw.
Now he could hear sirens coming from Castle Rock.
almost certainly FD responders. Rennie hoped their own two new and horribly expensive fire wagons were among them. It would play better if no one actually realized the new trucks had been out of town when this cluster mug happened. Ambulances and police would be close behind.
That ain't what happened, Alden Dinsmore said stubbornly. I was out in the side garden, and I saw the plane just...
Better move those people back, don't you think?
Rennie asked Randolph, pointing to the looky-loos.
There were quite a few on the pulp truck side, standing prudently away from the blazing remains, and even more on the mill side. It was starting to look like a convention.
Randolph addressed Morrison and Weddington.
Hank,
he said, and pointed at the spectators from the mill. Some had begun prospecting among the scattered pieces of Thompson's plane. There were cries of horror as more body parts were discovered.
Yo, Morrison said, and got moving.
Randolph turned Weddington toward the spectators on the pulp truck side.
Jackie, you take...
But there Randolph trailed off. The disaster groupies on the south side of the accident were standing in the cow pasture on one side of the road and knee-deep in scrubby bushes on the other. Their mouths hung open, giving them a look of stupid interest Rennie was very familiar with. He saw it on individual faces every day and en masse every March at town meeting. Only these people weren't looking at the burning truck. And now Peter Randolph, certainly no dummy, not brilliant, not by a long shot, but at least he knew which side his bread was buttered on, was looking at the same place as the rest of them, and with that same expression of slack-jawed amazement. So was Jackie Weddington. It was the smoke the rest were looking at. The smoke rising from the burning pulper. It was dark and oily. The people downwind should have been darn near choking on it, especially with a light breeze out of the south, but they weren't. And Rennie saw the reason why. It was hard to believe, but he saw it all right. The smoke did blow north, at least at first, but then it took an elbow bend, almost a right angle, and rose straight up in a plume, as if in a chimney. And it left a dark brown residue behind, a long smudge that just seemed to float on the air. Jim Rennie shook his head to clear the image away, but it was still there when he stopped.
What is it?
Randolph asked. His voice was soft with wonder. Dinsmore, the farmer, placed himself in front of Randolph.
That guy, pointing at Ernie Calvert, had Homeland Security on the phone, and this guy, pointing at Rennie in a theatrical courtroom gesture Rennie didn't care for in the least, took the phone out of his hand and hung up. He shouldn't have done that, Pete, because that was no collision. The plane wasn't anywhere near the ground. I seen it. I was covering plants in case of frost, and I seen it.
I did too,
Rory began, and this time it was his brother Ollie who went up the backside of Rory's head. Rory began to whine. Alden Dinsmore said,
It hit something. Same thing the truck hit. It's there. You can touch it. That young fella, the cook, said there ought to be a no-fly zone out here, and he was right. But Mr. Rennie,
again pointing at Rennie like he thought he was a gosh darn Perry Mason instead of a fellow who earned his daily bread attaching suction cups to cows' titties,
wouldn't even talk. Just hung up.
Rennie did not stoop to rebuttal.
You're wasting time, he told Randolph.
Moving a little closer and speaking just above a whisper, he added,
The chief's coming. My advice would be to look sharp and control this scene before it gets here.
He cast a cold momentary eye on the farmer.
You can interview the witnesses later.
But maddeningly, it was Alden Dinsmore who got the last word.
That fella Baba was right. He was right, and Rennie was wrong.
Rennie marked Alden Dinsmore for a later action. Sooner or later, farmers always came to the selectmen with their hats in their hands, wanting an easement, a zoning exception, something. And when Mr. Dinsmore next showed up, he would find little comfort, if Rennie had anything to say about it, and he usually did.
Control this scene, he told Randolph.
Jackie, move those people back,
the assistant chief said, pointing toward the looky-loos on the pulp truck side of the accident.
Establish a perimeter.
Sir, I think those folks are actually in Motton. I don't care. Move them back.
Randolph glanced over his shoulder to where Duke Perkins was working his way out of the Green Chief's car, a car Randolph longed to see in his own driveway, and would, with Big Jim Rennie's help, in another 3 years at the very latest.
Castle Rock PD will thank you when they get here, believe me.
What about...
She pointed at the smoke smudge, which was still spreading. Seen through it, the October colorful trees looked a uniform dark gray, and the sky was an unhealthy shade of yellowy blue.
Stay clear of it,
Randolph said, then went to help Hank Morrison establish the perimeter on the Chester's Mill side. First, he needed to bring Perk up to speed. Jackie approached the people on the pulp truck side. The crowd over there was growing all the time as the early arrivers worked their cell phones. Some had stamped out little fires in the bushes, which was good, but now they were just standing around gawking. She used the same shooing gestures Hank was employing on the mill side, and chanted the same mantra.
Get back, folks. It's all over. Nothing to see you haven't seen already. Clear the road for the fire trucks and the police. Get back. Clear the area. Go home. Get back.
She hit something. Rennie had no idea what it was, but he could see the result. The brim of her hat collided with it first. It bent, and the hat tumbled off behind her. An instant later, those insolent titties of hers, a couple of cotton-picking gun shells was what they were, flattened. Then her nose squashed and gave up a jet of blood that splattered against something and began to run down in long drips, like paint on a wall. She went on her well-padded ass with an expression of shock on her face. The god-darn farmer stuck his oar in then. See what I tell ya? Randolph and Morrison hadn't seen. Neither had Perkins. The three of them were conferring together by the hood of the chief's car. Rennie briefly considered going to Weddington, but others were doing that, and besides, she was still a little too close to whatever it was she'd run into. He hurried toward the men instead, set face and big, hard belly projecting get-her-done authority. He spared a glare for Farmer Dinsmore on his way by. Chief, he said, butting in between Morrison and Randolph.
Big Jim, Perkins said, nodding. You didn't waste any time, I see.
This was perhaps a jibe, but Rennie, a sly old fish, did not rise to the bait.
I'm afraid there's more going on here than meets the eye. I think someone had better get in touch with Homeland Security.
He paused, looking suitably grave.
I don't want to say there's terrorism involved, but I won't say there isn't.
3. Duke Perkins looked past Big Jim. Jackie was being helped to her feet by Ernie Calvert and Johnny Carver, who ran Mill Gas and Grocery. She was dazed, and her nose was bleeding, but she appeared all right otherwise. Nevertheless, this whole situation was hinky. Of course, any accident where there were fatalities felt that way to some extent, but there was more wrong here. For one thing, the plane hadn't been trying to land. There were too many pieces, and they were too widely scattered for him to believe that. And the spectators. They weren't right either. Randolph hadn't noticed, but Duke Perkins did. They should have formed into one big, spreading clump. It was what they always did, as if for comfort in the face of death. Only these had formed two clumps. And the one on the Motton side of the town line marker was awfully close to the still-burning truck. Not in any danger, he judged. But why didn't they move over here? The first fire truck swept around the curve to the south. Three of them. Duke was glad to see that the second one in line had Chester's Mill Fire Department Pumper Number 2 printed in gold on the side. The crowd shuffled back farther into the scrubby bushes, giving them room. Duke returned his attention to Rennie.
What happened here? Do you know?
Rennie opened his mouth to reply, but before he could, Ernie Calvert spoke up.
There's a barrier across the road. You can't see it. But it's there, Chief. The truck hit it. The plane, too.
Damn right, Dinsmore exclaimed.
Officer Weddington hit it, too, Johnny Carver said. Lucky for her, she was going slower.
He had placed an arm around Jackie, who looked dazed. Duke observed her blood on the sleeve of Carver's I got gassed at mill discount jacket.
On the Mountain side, another FD truck had arrived. The first two had blocked the road in a V. Firemen were already spilling out and unrolling hoses. Duke could hear the warble of an ambulance from the direction of Castle Rock. Where's ours? He wondered. Had it also gone to that stupid damn training exercise? He didn't like to think so. Who in their right mind would order an ambulance to an empty burning house?
There seems to be an invisible barrier, Rennie began.
Yeah, I got that, Duke said. I don't know what it means, but I got it. He left Rennie and went to his bleeding officer, not seeing the dark red color that suffused the second selectman's cheek at this snub.
Jackie, Duke asked, taking her gently by the shoulder.
All right.
Yeah.
She touched her nose where the blood flow was slowing. Does it look broken? It doesn't feel broken.
It's not broken, but it's going to swell. Think you'll look all right by the time the harvest ball comes around, though.
She offered a weak smile.
Chief, Rennie said, I really think we ought to call someone on this. If not Homeland Security, on more mature reflection, that seems a little radical.
Then perhaps the state police. Duke moved him aside. It was gentle, but unequivocal. Almost a push. Rennie balled his hands into fists, then unrolled them again. He had built a life in which he was a pusher, rather than a pushy. But that didn't alter the fact that fists were for idiots. Witness his own son. All the same, slights needed to be noted and addressed, usually at some later date. But sometimes, later was better. Sweeter.
Peter, Duke called to Randolph, give the health center a shout and ask where the hell our ambulance is. I want it out here.
Morrison can do that, Randolph said.
He had grabbed the camera from his car and was turning to snap pictures of the scene.
You can do it, and right now.
Chief, I don't think Jackie's too banged up, and no one else.
When I want your opinion, I'll ask for it, Peter.
Randolph started to give him a look, then saw the expression on Duke's face. He tossed the camera back onto the front seat of his shop and grabbed his cell phone.
What was it, Jackie?
Duke asked. I don't know. First there was a buzzy feeling like you get if you accidentally touch the prongs of a plug when you're sticking it into the wall. It passed, but then I hit... Jeez. I don't know what I hit. An ah sound went up from the spectators. The firemen had trained their hoses on the burning pulp truck, but beyond it, some of the spray was rebounding, striking something and splattering back, creating rainbows in the air. Duke had never seen anything like it in his life, except maybe when you were in a car wash, watching the high-pressure jets hit your windshield. Then he saw a rainbow on the mill side as well, a small one. One of the spectators, Lissa Jameson, the town librarian, walked toward it.
Lissa, get away from there, Duke shouted.
She ignored him. It was as if she were hypnotized. She stood inches from where a jet of high-pressure water was striking thin air and splashing back. Her hands spread. He could see drops of mist sparkling on her hair, which was pulled away from her face and bunned at the back. The little rainbow broke up, then reformed behind her.
Nothing but mist, she called, sounding rapturous. All that water over there, and nothing but mist over here. Like from a humidifier.
Peter Randolph held up his cell phone and shook his head.
I get a signal, but I'm not getting through. My guess is that all these spectators, he swept his arm in a big arc, have got everything jammed up.
Duke didn't know if that were possible, but it was true that almost everyone he could see was either yakking or taking pictures. Except for Lissa, that was, who was still doing her wood nymph imitation.
Go get her, Duke told Randolph. Pull her back before she decides to haul out her crystals or something.
Randolph's face suggested that such errands were far below his pay grade, but he went. Duke uttered a laugh. It was short, but genuine.
What in the goodness sakes do you see that's worth laughing about? Rennie asked.
More Castle County cops were pulling up on the Motton side. If Perkins didn't look out, the Rock would end up taking control of this thing and getting the gosh darn credit. Duke stopped laughing, but he was still smiling, unabashed.
"It's a cluster mug," he said. "Isn't that your word, Big Jim? And in my experience, sometimes laughing is the only way to deal with a cluster mug."
"I have no idea what you're talking about," Rennie almost shouted. The Dinsmore boys stepped back from him and stood beside their father.
"I know," Duke spoke gently, "and that's okay. All you need to understand right now is that I'm the chief law enforcement officer on the scene, at least until the county sheriff gets here, and you're a town selectman. You have no official standing, so I'd like you to move back."
Duke raised his voice and pointed to where Officer Henry Morrison was stringing yellow tape, stepping around two largish pieces of airplane fuselage to do it.
"I'd like everyone to move back and let us do our job. Follow Selectman Rennie. He's going to lead you behind the yellow tape."
"I don't appreciate this, Duke," Rennie said. "God bless you, but I don't give a shit," Duke said. "Get off my scene, Big Jim, and be sure to go around the tape. No need for Henry to have to string it twice."
"Chief Perkins, I want you to remember how you spoke to me today, because I will."
Rennie stalked toward the tape. The other spectators followed, most looking over their shoulders to watch the water spray off the diesel-smudged barrier and form a line of wetness on the road. A couple of the sharper ones, Ernie Calvert, for instance, had already noticed that this line exactly mimicked the border between Motton and the mill. Rennie felt a childish temptation to snap Hank Morrison's carefully strung tape with his chest, but he restrained himself. He would not, however, go around and get his Land's End slacks snagged in a mess of burdocks. They had cost him $60. He shuffled under, holding up the tape with one hand. His belly made serious ducking impossible. Behind him, Duke walked slowly toward the place where Jackie had suffered her collision. He held one hand outstretched before him like a blind man prospecting his way across an unfamiliar room. Here was where she had fallen down. And here. He felt the buzzing she had described, but instead of passing, it deepened to searing pain in the hollow of his left shoulder. He had just enough time to remember the last thing Brenda had said. "Take care of your pacemaker." And then it exploded in his chest with enough force to blow open his Wildcat sweatshirt, which he'd donned that morning in honor of this afternoon's game. Blood, scraps of cotton, and bits of flesh struck the barrier. The crowd awed. Duke tried to speak his wife's name and failed, but he saw her face clearly in his mind. She was smiling. Then, darkness. 4. The kid was Benny Drake, 14, and a Razor. The Razors were a small but dedicated skateboarding club, frowned on by the local constabulary, but not actually outlawed, in spite of calls from Selectman Rennie and Sanders for such action. At last March's town meeting, this same dynamic duo had succeeded in tabling a budget item that would have funded a safe skateboarding area on the town common behind the bandstand. The adult was Eric Rusty Everett, 37, a physician's assistant working with Dr. Ron Haskell, whom Rusty often thought of as the Wonderful Wizard of Oz, because, Rusty would have explained, if he'd anyone other than his wife he could trust with such disloyalty, he so often remains behind the curtain while I do the work. Now he checked the state of young Master Drake's last tetanus shot. Fall of 2009, very good. Especially considering that young Master Drake had done a Wilson while cement shooting and torn up his calf pretty good. Not a total Jake, but a lot worse than simple road rash. "Power's back on, dude," young Master Drake offered. "Generator, dude," Rusty said. "Handles the hospital and the health center. Radical, huh?" "Old school," young Master Drake agreed. For a moment, the adult and the adolescent regarded the 6-inch gash in Benny Drake's calf without speaking. Cleaned of dirt and blood, it looked ragged, but no longer downright awful. The town whistle had quit, but far in the distance, they could hear sirens. Then the fire whistle went off, making them both jump. Ambulance is gonna roll, Rusty thought. Sure as shit. Twitching Everett right again. Better hurry this up. Except the kid's face was pretty white, and Rusty thought there were tears standing in his eyes. Scared? Rusty asked. A little, Benny Drake said. Ma's gonna ground me. Is that what you're scared of? Because he guessed that Benny Drake had been grounded a few times before, like, often, dude. Well, how much is it gonna hurt? Rusty had been hiding the syringe. Now he injected 3 cc's of xylocaine and epinephrine, a deadening compound he still called Novocaine. He took his time infiltrating the wound, so as not to hurt the kid any more than he had to. About that much.
Whoa, Benny said. Stat, baby. Code blue.
Rusty laughed. Did you full pipe before you Wilsoned? As a long retired boarder, he was honestly curious.
Only half, but it was toxic, Benny said, brightening. How many stitches do you think Nori Calvert took 12 when she ledged out in Oxford last summer?
Not that many, Rusty said. He knew Nori, a mini-goth whose chief aspiration seemed to be killing herself on a skateboard before burying her first Woods Colt. He pressed near the wound with the needle end of the syringe. Feel that?
Yeah, dude, totally. Did you hear, like, a bang out there?
Benny pointed vaguely south as he sat on the examining table in his undershorts, bleeding onto the paper cover.
Nope, Rusty said.
He had actually heard 2, not bangs, but he was afraid explosions. Had to make this fast. Where was the wizard? Doing rounds, according to Ginny, which probably meant snoozing in the Kathy Russell doctor's lounge. It was where the wonderful Wiz did most of his rounds these days. Feel it now? Rusty poked again with the needle.
Don't look, looking is cheating.
No, man, nothing, you're goofing with me.
I'm not, you're numb.
In more ways than one, Rusty thought.
Okay, here we go, lie back, relax, and enjoy flying Kathy Russell Airlines.
He scrubbed the wound with sterile saline, debrided, then trimmed with his trusty number 10 scalpel.
6 stitches with my very best 4-0 nylon.
Awesome, the kid said. Then I think I may hurl.
Rusty handed him an emesis basin, in these circumstances known as a puke pan.
Hurl in this, faint, and you're on your own.
Benny didn't faint. He didn't hurl either. Rusty was placing a sterile gauze sponge on the wound when there was a perfunctory knock at the door, followed by Ginny Tomlinson's head.
Can I speak to you for a minute?
Don't worry about me, Benny said. I'm like freely radical.
Cheeky little bugger.
In the hall, Rusty, Ginny said.
She didn't give the kid a glance.
I'll be right back, Benny. Sit there and relax.
Chillax and no prob.
Rusty followed Ginny out into the hall.
Ambulance time? He asked.
Beyond Ginny, in the sunny waiting room, Benny's mother was looking grimly down at a paperback with a sweet savage cover. Ginny nodded.
119 at the Tarker's town line. There's another accident on the other town line, Martin, but I'm hearing everyone involved in that one is DATS.
Dead at the scene.
Truck-plane collision. The plane was trying to land.
Are you shitting me?
Alva Drake looked around, frowning, then went back to her paperback. Or at least to looking at it while she tried to decide if her husband would support her in grounding Benny until he was 18.
This is an authentic no-shit situation, Ginny said. I'm getting reports of other crashes, too.
Weird.
But the guy out on the Tarker's town line is still alive, rolled a delivery truck, I believe. Buzz, cuz. Twitch is waiting.
You'll finish the kid?
Yes. Go on, go.
Dr. Rayburn?
Had patients in Stevens Memorial.
This was the Norway South Paris Hospital.
He's on his way, Rusty. Go.
He paused on his way out to tell Mrs. Drake that Benny was fine. Alva did not seem overjoyed at the news, but thanked him. Dougie Twitchell, Twitch,
was sitting on the bumper of the out-of-date ambulance Jim Rennie and his fellow selectmen kept not replacing, smoking a cigarette and taking some sun. He was holding a portable CB, and it was lively with talk, voices popping like corn and jumping all over each other. "Put out that cancer stick and let's get rolling," Rusty said. "You know where we're going, right?" Twitch flipped the butt away. Despite his nickname, he was the calmest nurse Rusty had ever encountered, and that was saying a lot.
"I know what Jinjin told you. Tarker's Chester's down line, right?"
"Yes, overturned truck."
"Yeah, well, plans have changed. We gotta go the other way."
He pointed to the southern horizon where a thick black pillar of smoke was rising.
"Ever had a desire to see a crashed plane?"
"I have," Rusty said. "In the service, two guys, you could have spread what was left on bread. That was plenty for me, Pilgrim. Ginny says they're all dead out there, so why?"
"Maybe so, maybe no," Twitch said. "But now Perkins is down, and he might not be."
"Chief Perkins?"
"The very same. I'm thinking the prognosis ain't good if the pacemaker blew right out of his chest, which is what Peter Randolph is claiming. But he is the chief of police, fearless leader."
"Twitch, buddy, a pacemaker can't blow like that. It's perfectly impossible."
"Then maybe he is still alive, and we can do some good," Twitch said.
Halfway around the hood of the ambo, he took out his cigarettes. "You're not smoking in the ambulance," Rusty said. Twitch looked at him sadly. "Unless you share, that is." Twitch sighed and handed him the pack.
"Ah, Marlboros," Rusty said. "My very favorite OPs."
"You slay me," Twitch said.
5. They blew through the stoplight where Route 117 teed into 119 at the center of town. Siren blaring, both of them smoking like fiends, with the windows open, which was SOP, listening to the chatter from the radio. Rusty understood little of it, but he was clear on one thing. He was going to be working long past 4 o'clock.
"Man, I don't know what happened," Twitch said. "But there's this. We're going to see a genuine aircraft crash site. Post-crash, true, but beggars cannot be choosers."
"Twitch, you're one sick canine." There was a lot of traffic mostly headed south. A few of these folks might have legitimate errands, but Rusty thought most were human flies being drawn to the smell of blood. Twitch passed a line of 4 with no problem. The northbound lane of 119 was oddly empty.
"Look," Twitch said, pointing. "News chopper. We're going to be on the 6 o'clock news, Big Rusty. Heroic paramedics fight to..."
But that was where Dougie Twitchell's flight of fancy ended. Ahead of them, at the accident site, Rusty presumed, the helicopter did a button hook. For a moment, he could read the number 13 on its side and see the CBSI. Then, it exploded, raining down fire from the cloudless early afternoon sky. Twitch cried out.
"Jesus, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it."
And then childishly, hurting Rusty's heart even in his shock,
"I take it back."
6.
"Now I gotta go back," Gendron said.
He took off his sea dog's cap and wiped his bloody, grimy, pallid face with it. His nose had swollen until it looked like a giant's thumb. His eyes peered out of dark circles.
"I'm sorry, but my schnoz is hurting like hell, and, well, I ain't as young as I used to be. Also..."
He raised his arms and dropped them. They were facing each other, and Barbie would have taken the guy in his arms and given him a pat on the back if it were possible. "Shock to the system, isn't it?" he asked Gendron. Gendron gave a bark of laughter.
"That copter was the final touch."
And they both looked toward the fresh column of smoke. Barbie and Gendron had gone on from the accident site on 117 after making sure that the witnesses were getting help for Elsa Andrews, the sole survivor. At least she didn't seem badly hurt, although she was clearly heartbroken over the loss of her friend. "Going back then, slow, take your time. Rest when you need to."
"Pushing on?"
"Yes."
"Still think you're going to find the end of it?"
Barbie was silent for a moment.
At first, he'd been sure, but now...
I hope so, he said.
Well, good luck.
Chandran tipped his cap to Barbie before putting it back on.
I hope to shake your hand before the day's out.
Me too, Barbie said. He paused. He had been thinking. Can you do something for me if you can get to your cell phone?
Sure.
Call the Army base at Fort Benning. Ask for the liaison officer and tell them you need to get in touch with Colonel James O. Cox. Tell them it's urgent, that you're calling for Captain Dale Barbara. Can you remember that?
Dale Barbara, that's you. James Cox, that's him.
Got it.
If you reach him, I'm not sure you will, but if, tell him what's going on here.
Tell him if no one's gotten in touch with Homeland Security, he's the man. Can you do that?
Chandran nodded.
If I can, I will. Good luck, soldier.
Barbie could have done without ever having been called that again, but he touched a finger to his forehead. Then he went on, looking for what he no longer thought he would find. 7. He found a woods road that roughly paralleled the barrier. It was overgrown and disused, but much better than pushing through the pucker brush. Every now and then he diverted to the west, feeling for the wall between Chester's Mill and the outside world. It was always there. When Barbie came to where 119 crossed into the mill's sister town of Tarker's Mills, he stopped. The driver of the overturned delivery truck had been taken away by some Good Samaritan on the other side of the barrier, but the truck itself lay blocking the road like a big dead animal. The back doors had sprung open on impact. The tar was littered with devil dogs, ho-hos, ring-dings, Twinkies, and peanut butter crackers. A young man in a George Strait t-shirt sat on a stump, eating one of the latter. He had a cell phone in hand. He looked up at Barbie.
Yo, did you come from...
He pointed vaguely behind Barbie. He looked tired and scared and disillusioned. From the other side of town, Barbie said. Right.
Invisible wall the whole way. Border closed.
Yes. The young man nodded and hit a button on his cell.
Dusty, you there yet?
He listened some more, then said,
okay.
He ended the call.
My friend Dusty and I started east of here. Split up. He went south. We've been staying in touch by phone. When we can get through, that is. He's where the copter crashed now. Says it's getting crowded there.
Barbie bet it was.
No break in this thing anywhere on your side?
The young man shook his head. He didn't say more. I didn't need to. They could have missed breaks. Barbie knew that was possible. Holes the size of windows or doors. But he doubted it. He thought they were cut off.